quite sure regarding the quality of sound. We have just landed at the airport a few minutes ago, and my ears still haven't popped yet. But it's a great pleasure to be here. As a matter of fact, it's a pleasure to be away from Sacramento. Because you can imagine what it's like meeting all day with the legislature and meeting with the cabinet, meeting with my tax advisor. You know, seriously, the newspapers, well, I have to say this one thing, though, because anymore there seems to be a something that's almost as prevalent as relevancy or any of the other things, the terms that we seem to be using all the time, and that is the need to communicate. And yesterday I met with a group of college students up there in the Capitol, the whole idea of trying to bridge the gap and communicating everything. And I've told this story before, and perhaps some of you have heard me, but whenever I talk about communicating, I think how important it is, not only for what you say, but how you say it. And to illustrate this is two priests, one of the Dominican order and one of the Benedictine order, who had a common addiction. They were addicted to the use of tobacco, and it was a great distress to them to go through their long devotionals without smoking, and they used to discuss this at great length, and finally they decided that they would take it up with the Pope as to whether possibly it was all right to smoke during the devotionals. And later, the Benedictine met the Dominican, and he said, "Did you ask?" And he said, "Yes." And what did the Pope say? The Pope said, "No." Well, he said, "How did you ask him?" And he said, "Well, I simply wrote and asked him if it was all right to smoke while we were praying." And he said, "No." The Benedictine said, "Well, you didn't ask him right." He said, "I wrote and asked him if it was all right if I prayed while I was smoking." He said, "Yes." Funny, he said, you grow up, you get out in the real world, and you discover they were right. Well, those of us who are on the shady side of 30 smile when we hear comments like that, because it's like an echo of our own youthful feelings. Sooner or later, almost everyone learns to appreciate the wisdom of an older generation, the wisdom that was learned the hard way. Much of the so-called generation gap, I think, that we hear about is less a lack of communication or an effort to communicate than it is a refusal to listen by one side or the other. Now, there's no impossible gap between the establishment and the younger generation. The best evidence of that is the very existence of such organizations as this. Because PTA is almost a charter member of the establishment. There's no getting around that. And yet no one's more vitally concerned with youth and its problems than the parents and the teachers who band together to try and find solutions to those problems. No organization that I know of is more keenly attuned to the need for constructive change, when change will improve the educational opportunities for our young people. Now, contrary to what some of you may have been led to believe, those of us who have an executive responsibility in the state government share your concern about improving our public schools. It just ain't true that I don't set no store by book learning. Education is and continues to be California's number one priority. Since there seems to be some confusion about the subject, I'd like to briefly recap just how the state has been meeting this commitment. During the past 4 years, public schools, grades kindergarten through 14, have received an increase of more than $500 million in the annual state aid to education. This is the greatest four-year increase in the state's history. Almost half of our general fund is devoted to education. And if the size of the classes have gone down, state assistance to public schools has gone up 3 times faster than the increase in enrollment. At a time now when enrollment is actually showing a slight decline in the lower grades, there are fewer five-year-olds in California than six-year-olds, fewer four-year-olds than five-year-olds, the demand for more and more state financial support continues. Now, this atmosphere of crisis is nothing new. During the past World War II era, when the state's population grew so swiftly, Californians dug deep into their pockets to finance the finest educational system they could afford for their children. The school finance issue seemed always to be the latest and the most important crisis confronting the state. Well, it is still important. But population and enrollment growth has been slowing in recent years. And it seems that our citizens have been questioning both the efficiency of the schools and the results they're producing. They demonstrate this time after time, as you well know, by voting down school bond issues and tax rate increases. They no longer accept the argument that simply more money will solve all the problems concerning our schools. And I have to confess, I believe they're right. More money is not the only answer. We know that we must simplify the outmoded and inequitable system of allocating the state school assistance. Fairness to our homeowners in our state requires a comprehensive property tax reform so that the educational system will not be so heavily dependent on this source of revenue. Internally, education must emphasize a stronger curriculum without frills, and schools must develop more realistic goals so that students graduating will have skills that can be put to use immediately in the job market if they don't choose to go on to college. Will not by themselves restore the public's confidence in our schools. Our citizens are simply not convinced that education is getting a dollar's worth of value from every tax dollar it spends. The other night I was speaking at a high school which was honoring its students for scholastic achievements, a little community in Loomis just north of Sacramento. And here was a classic example of the people of this country in their typical fashion, resisting government imposition, but at the same time showing their personal willingness to do what they felt was a priority thing that needed doing. Because in this little high school, the parents, the people of that community, have twice in succession turned down tax overrides, and yet they have voluntarily joined in to build a $250,000 stadium. They have built an Olympic-sized swimming pool, and when the school needed painting on a weekend, they got the paint, and the parents and the citizens of the community went in and painted the school. You can't say that they don't have an interest in their school, and yet they will refuse the imposition of this additional tax. Studies by various groups and events continually strengthen the suspicion with regard to the use of the education dollar. 1970 management study by an independent group here in our state disclosed that one major school district was financing expensive out-of-state recruiting trips to try and hire teachers at a time when they had 15 applicants on file for every teaching vacancy. This same district was paying excessive prices on a wide range of housekeeping items, 900% more than other school districts for window cleaners, 38% more for paper towels than other districts which utilized mass purchasing techniques and provided better inventory controls. Some districts encountering financial difficulties have discovered they have no fixed budget procedures whatsoever, no formal written guidelines for allocating the funds that it had available. This kind of wasteful administration, which may be prevalent in far too many school districts, must be ended. In short, we need a management revolution in education to implement and enforce effective cost controls. Education produced the scientific and management techniques which enabled America to put a man on the moon. And yet many areas of education remain largely unaffected by this management revolution, which has so greatly improved administrative techniques in business, industry, and agriculture, and yes, even government. Basic cost controls have nothing to do with educational philosophy or the arguments about which teaching method is best. Equipping and operating the schools at the least possible cost is simply good management. It's common sense in action. It is a type of management that schools are going to have to institute if we're to stretch the available financial resources to provide the quality instruction we want. And we've had some progress in our efforts to develop long-range and short-range solutions. I always feel a little self-conscious when I talk about that because, you know, sometimes you have to confess that long-range studies are merely to cover up short-range failures. But legislation that was adopted last year modified the certification process for school superintendents. And now, if they choose, districts have and seek the services of men and women that are experienced in business management, rather than being bound to recruiting school district officials only among those whose training is largely in educational theory. But much more needs to be done. This management revolution isn't confined to the efficient buying of paper clips or window cleaners. We must constantly examine the internal structure of education itself to make sure that the solutions proposed in the past really are the right answers. Now, let me cite an example that's familiar, I'm sure, to every one of you here today. For a number of years, California has been making a concerted effort to reduce the class size on the theory that smaller classes assure more effective techniques and teaching and greater learning. But now we have to say, does it? New York City also sought to improve school performance by reducing the size of classes. But when it undertook a comprehensive study of the results, the outcome was very surprising. They found that the traditional factors that are supposed to determine how well or how fast a child learns, size of the class, pupil-teacher ratio, amount of school expenditures, and even the experience of the teachers, seem to have no detectable impact upon school performance. On the contrary, the White House educational advisor said that the New York results show that the students in those schools which cost the most per pupil and had the smallest classes were lagging well behind in reading and arithmetic achievement levels. Now, there's been a similar study that is in education is probably the finest study ever made, the Coleman Report of 3 years ago, and it concluded the teacher-pupil ratios had a consistent lack of relationship to the achievement level of all the students under all conditions. Now, I'm certainly not advocating larger classes or suggesting that California schools may not require additional financial support. I am reminding you that educators who insist on measuring schools only by the amount of money spent are using the wrong yardstick. And the most tragic part of this is that it's the students who pay the heaviest price for blindly equating progress in education with the size of the budget. California can't afford to give blank check financing to any area of government. must find ways to improve education's performance. And you can help. You can help by encouraging the kind of innovative and constructive changes that we must have in our schools or to meet the education needs of our youth. Education, as well as other areas of government, must be accountable to the people for the results it produces. Now, I think that you and all of us have to face head-on the absolute necessity of efficiency in the schools and in every area that is financed by public revenues. We know in Sacramento this can be done. I think many of you are familiar with the fact that in the first year of this administration, we went to the public, we sought volunteers to form task forces, some 250 leading and successful citizens in our state here went out into the various state departments, and they came back with hundreds and hundreds of recommendations as to how government could be made more efficient and more economic. We have implemented more than 900 of those recommendations, and today we actually have departments with 30% and 40% workload increases since 4 years ago, performing their tasks with fewer employees than we found 4 years ago. And yet our state has increased in population by more than a million in these 4 years. Had we followed the previous policy of state government expansion, today we would have in excess of 20,000 more state employees than we had then. And as it is, we have fewer employees than we had 4 years ago. Now the financial squeeze that we face in California isn't unusual. Every state local government in the nation is facing the same problem. The reason can be traced to a single situation that's common throughout the country. It is the tremendous and the ever-rising cost of public welfare. Now, I realize that many of you in this audience are convinced that public schools aren't getting enough state support, even though half our budget or almost half goes to education. But I hope you also realize how vital it is to government bring this other area under control, welfare spending. Because unless we do, there won't be money sufficient to adequately finance any of the other essential government services that we must provide. Schools and health programs, environmental protection, improved highways, urban transportation. All the various programs in these areas are in direct competition with welfare for the tax revenues. Our state constitution tells us that schools are to have first priority on available tax revenues. But we're faced with a kind of dichotomy, a double assignment. The Constitution is still true. But at the same time, we have mandated on us programs in which we must make provision for those in public welfare. And one of the things that's binding us down, making it impossible for us to meet other responsibilities, is the complex maze of federal, state, and local regulations, which result in virtually no control over how many people go on the public assistance rolls. Nor is there any effective check against some of the unbelievable examples of welfare abuse that we have uncovered. How can anyone defend a system that allows persons earning $12,000 to $14,000 a year to legally qualify for public assistance? Finance welfare benefits for people who have entered this country illegally, or who haven't lived in our state for a year but simply come here to take advantage of our benefits. Hey! Benefits be paid to people that are earning up to $600 a month, while families of the same size struggle to get by on less than half that amount, and yet each is required as a legitimate and a legal individual entitled to the same size welfare check. One out of every 9 Californians is drawing some sort of welfare benefit today. And unless something is done to change this, by the middle of next year, it will be 1 out of 7, a total of 3 million people. And where will it stop? If ever, because the rate of growth at the moment is 50,000 new recipients each month. Yeah. frankly, I am out of patience with the cheap demagoguery of those who in opposition can only scream that such a reform program is evidence of a lack of heart that shows no compassion for the poor. They know that. Talking about will come from rooting out fraud and abuse, and that our purpose is actually to provide bigger grants for those destitute mothers who are not now receiving enough to adequately feed and raise their children. In addition, we intend in that program to provide financial incentives to the counties so they can track down fathers who have abandoned their children and who refuse to pay child support. $5 a month from half of the 250,000 absent parents in the AFDC program, we could reduce our cost by $100 million a year. Now, I'm sure some of you remember last year in the legislative session the long struggle over more school aid and how we had to prune and scrape and trim to find about $100 million to provide public schools with a cost of living increase in state aid. Anyone suggest that we not make every effort to collect another $100 million a year from absent fathers who deserted their families and have thrown the entire burden of their support on the state? The same state which has an obligation to educate all its children and is having a difficult time providing enough money to do it. These are questions that you should be asking yourselves when you add up how much more state support you think the schools will require. It doesn't make any difference whether we agree with the figure that you come up with or not. Because unless we curb the cost of welfare and reform public assistance, it won't matter whether we agree with the figure that you come up for, because there won't be any additional revenue, federal, state, or local, to spread among the schools or the health programs or anything else. The reforms we propose are reasonable and necessary steps. Many have been suggested by county supervisors and welfare directors. They viewed at first hand the destructive result of the current welfare program. And they know that the biggest cost is not in money. The worst impact is the destruction of the moral values that made America great. You know, I can give you one example, just one of the many we've found that indicate the erosion of moral values values that have always been characteristic of America. Need I tell you anything more that in the climate of this day, a young man in one of our cities here, with no dependents, earning $800 a month, went to court, his lawyers provided a taxpayer's expense by OEO, and sued to prevent the county from forcing him to contribute $20 a month to his aged mother's support. And he won the suit. The court ruled that his mother is not his responsibility. She's society's responsibility now. Ironically, it is the very material success our society is built on. Built on those values that allows us the luxury of dictating how much public assistance we should provide. Even if there were no urgent financial necessity, we couldn't afford a welfare system that is slowly destroying a part of our society's most precious resource, its people. The vision and the faith and the sacrifice that built our society is part of the American character. It's part of our heritage to provide equal opportunity to all. Education, the field of interest which brought everyone here today, is the best way to provide that opportunity. Those of you who are interested in better schools and more financing for various educational programs, legislature what a priority you place on education. Quite frankly, there's only one choice for those who have the best interests of our society, and that's to demand and support every effort at welfare reform. Unless we achieve it, we'll never be able to give education the financial priority it deserves. We'll go on year after year with an almost annual tax increase every year, simply to pay for the increases in welfare. We will accompany that by reducing each year the spending on education and the cutting back of other legitimate government functions until eventually we reach the breaking point, the disaster level. And we don't have to turn to ancient Rome when the mobs riot in the street. We don't have to go to England back in the 1800s when there were burning of cities, demoralization of labor and rioting because of the breakdown of their welfare program, which incidentally was almost identical to what we have today. No, we only have to look at the press of the day reporting what is taking place right now in one of our great eastern states, which over recent years has gone beyond California in its generosity in this field and its lack of controls and its spending, and now has come to that point that we're trying to avoid. I have on my desk a very thick packet of the press release that was sent out by this state of the cuts they must make in order to simply come through the present year. And many of those cuts are in the field of education. They're going to fire more than 8,000 of their state employees in this time of unemployment and hardship. They're going to not open their state parks for several weeks several weeks later in the spring than normal. They're going to close them earlier in the fall. They're going to reduce the number of hours that their vacation beaches are open. They are closing down rehabilitation programs in the field of juvenile delinquency and in the field of physical handicaps. Not because they don't need them, but because they no longer can pay for them. And as I say, page after page of what it is they're cutting back. And at the same time, you read in the press today, that because some of the cutbacks are in welfare, the mobs are loose in the streets and the municipal fire department is refusing to go into the area and put out the fire they've set because of the threat to their lives.
Right.
We are proposing a welfare reform that will do nothing but remove cheaters, do nothing but reduce the grants to people who have sizable earnings in excess of $600 a month. And at the same time, we intend to increase the grants to the truly needy. And yet in the one place, the nation, with the nation demanding welfare reform, where we're having difficulty getting acceptance of such a proposal, is here in our own state government. This is why, again, as I say, if we are to proceed with the great things that we've done in California and are doing, and they are great, and too little attention has been paid, I think you might like to know that all of our efforts have not just been economy in the last few years. I think you'd like to know that California is the one state in the union that does not have bulging and crowded prisons. We have fewer prisoners in our state prisons than we had back in 1962. Because our parole system is working, we have cut in half the number of parolees who returned to prison. We're closing some of our honor camps, not because these camps where the young juvenile lawbreakers have gone and fight our forest fires and so forth. We're closing several of these camps not because they aren't satisfactory or we don't intend to keep on with this kind of program, but because our probation system is so successful in the last few years that we no longer have the juvenile delinquents to put in those camps. They're empty. And in the field of mental health, we, by stipulating that you
all on the street,
outpatient clinics, have reduced the population. Those people who once were stored away in mental hospitals to spend the rest of their lives there. We've reduced the hospital population from over 31,000 to 11,500.